talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchteroin, Argus, Akoiza.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, in the aftermath of the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump, we're looking at shootings in American presidential history as we find out about the four presidents who were killed in office and the presidential candidates who faced the shadow of the gunman. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Last week, we looked at the early history of the Olympics, from ancient Greece to the revival in 1896, and we debated the fascinating history and cultural impact of this global phenomenon. And if you want to listen back to this or to any of our older shows, just go to the website newstalk.com, the Newstalk app, or wherever you download your podcasts. The attempted assassination of presidential candidate and former American President Donald Trump on the 13th of July 2024 joins a long and growing list of shootings of American presidents, former presidents and presidential candidates. Four American presidents have been killed in office: Abraham Lincoln, James Garfield, William McKinley and John F. Kennedy. Two former presidents have been shot while on the campaign trail: Theodore Roosevelt and Donald Trump. And we also have the tragedy of Bobby Kennedy, killed while campaigning for the Democratic nomination in 1968. In 1981, President Ronald Reagan narrowly escaped with his life after a failed assassination attempt.
Just to recap then, there has been an assassination attempt on President Reagan. The president has been hit. He has a wound, we believe, in his upper shoulder. His condition, according to the White House, is stable.
It happened as the president was leaving the St. Francis Hotel after his last scheduled appearance. The president appeared stunned momentarily, but he was not hit. He was quickly pushed into a crouching position, into his limousine, and in moments the motorcade was underway, rushing away from the trouble area toward the airport.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
And so in tonight's show, we want to look at the history of shootings in American presidential history as we debate a violent history which has become all too current. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Daniel Mulhall is a distinguished former diplomat and historian and was Ireland's ambassador to the United States between 2017 and 2022 during the presidencies of Donald Trump and Joe Biden. And his latest book is Pilgrim's Soul, W.B. Yeats and the Ireland of His Time. Professor Michael Cullinan is the Lohman Walter Endowed Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies at Dickinson State University in North Dakota and is the public historian for the Theodore Roosevelt Association. And he's the author of Remembering Theodore Roosevelt, as well as a contributor to the design and curation of the Theodore Roosevelt's Presidential Library, due to open in 2026. And we're also delighted to be joined by Sean Defoe, the political correspondent for Bauer Media. Well, you're all very welcome. And later in the show, I'll be joined by Dr. Sandra Scanlon, who lectures in American history in the UCD School of History. Well, as I say, you are all very welcome. And Dan Mulhall, we might begin with you. And it is shocking that we are able to do an entire program on shootings in American presidential history, that they have been so frequent, successful or unsuccessful, and that the recent tragic events that we saw in Pennsylvania last weekend really brings that home.
It certainly does. And I suppose it reflects the nature of American society going back to the 19th century and beyond, and the importance of the gun in American life. I mean, I was shocked during my time in Washington, D.C., to meet people like myself, you know, people who I would regard as, you know, my peers and so on, who had arsenals in their homes. And it's something that people in Ireland and most parts of Europe just can't find it hard to fathom. So the gun is just part of American history. And I remember somebody, a senior American figure indeed, telling me to watch the movie Who Shot Liberty Valance to understand, you know, the background to the importance of the gun in American history. But one of the things that strikes me is that there have been a few assassinations of consequential presidents. I'm thinking of Lincoln and John F. Kennedy in particular. But a lot of people who maybe are vaguely familiar with American history probably wouldn't have heard much of James Garfield, and maybe even wouldn't have heard of William McKinley so much, because he was overshadowed by his successor, Teddy Roosevelt. So, and the other thing that's shocking as well is that even someone as inconsequential as a president as Gerald Ford, who after all was never elected president and failed to get re-elected at the end of his term when he succeeded Richard Nixon, he was the subject of two assassination attempts, as was Ronald Reagan. So it's not just consequential presidents who have been the victims of assassination attempts or assassinations, but it's also figures that we would see as relatively inconsequential in American history.
And Dan, given that you have all of these school shootings as well, and that they don't lead to a massive change, probably the shootings of presidents and presidential candidates isn't going to make a change either. And I wonder, Dan, if this had been the other way around, if it had been Joe Biden who had been shot at, you probably would have had an increase in the conspiracy theories and people refusing to accept that it was real and that this was all part of the deep state trying to ensure his re-election.
Well, I don't think there'll be any shortage. Are there any shortage of conspiracy theories about this particular assassination attempt? It was a terrible thing. It has to be condemned. It's got no place in a democratic society. But unfortunately, as we've been discussing, it has a long history in America. And yes, of course, this will be seen in a partisan way. Republicans will see it as some kind of effort by the deep state to get rid of Donald Trump. That failed. Alongside the gun culture that is a feature of American society, conspiracy theories are also a very, very strongly part of American history. And for example, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is still a candidate for the presidency this year, the son of Bobby Kennedy, who was assassinated in 1968 when he was a candidate, he doesn't believe that the person who spent the last 50 plus years in jail, Sirhan Sirhan, was actually the assassin who killed his father. He believes there was some other gunman there. So he also, of course, is someone who believes in other conspiracy theories. So the conspiracy theory, unfortunately, is as much part of American life as the gun culture that we have been talking about.
And we might explore some of those conspiracy theories as well. Sean, when you look at the attempted assassination of Donald Trump last weekend, it is a date that will go down as one of the significant moments in American presidential history. And because here you have a presidential candidate, but also someone who is a former president himself.
And something that happened live on television as well. The commentary was instant. The reaction was instant. It's the first one really of the social media generation as well. So you just saw the coverage and the conspiracy theories almost coming instantly on tap with that, like Dan was saying. So it just has one of those zeitgeist moments of really the 21st century straight away captured and put out in front of us. And when people woke up to it, there was this sense of shock. Not necessarily a sense of shock that happened, but in the way that it happened. Because I think if you said to a lot of people, even 10 years ago, that at some point in his career, Donald Trump would be the subject of an assassination attempt, people would say, yeah, okay, I could see that because of the gun culture in the US, because of what he represents and how divisive he's been. But it's interesting the point you touched on with Dan. You know, is this going to be a change moment? And that's what a lot of, you know, we had some Democrats on the show on Sunday morning when it happened, saying that they hoped it would, and that maybe now that it's come home for him and he's literally lost a piece of his ear over it, maybe he'll have a bit of a change of heart that any normal human being would have. I don't think that is going to be the case, because if you're expecting Trump to have some sort of come to Jesus moment, it's more going to be an I am Jesus moment. It's going to be a lot of religious iconography out of it, that he was saved for a particular reason and saved by inches from this shooter. And you can see that, I think, even in the commentary that's gone since, people straight away calling it a miracle. Praise God that he's saved, tapping into that religious fundamentalism in the United States. States, rather than something that he's now going to come out and say, well, we need to get tougher on gun control because if this can happen to me, it can happen to anyone.
And it kind of insulates him for the rest of the election campaign, because in the next debate or at any public appearance, he could stumble over his words, he could make huge mistakes, he could, you know, he could fall down, and none of it will matter because it will all be seen as maybe a side effect of the shooting.
Do you remember him himself saying, I could shoot somebody outside of Trump Tower and get away with it, so popular I am, and now the flip has come. So it's a really difficult one for the Democrats in how they attack them. Straight away, the Republican lines were, well, this is the fault of the Democrats, that you've been demonising this man, saying that he's the worst thing to happen to the United States and he's going to take away democracy and all this. And when you ramp up that rhetoric, you know, ironies of the MAGA Republicans saying, talking about ramping up rhetoric, that it's going to lead to something like this. So it presents a very, all the questions about Biden and his candidacy aside, whoever is the Democratic candidate has a really difficult job now, because if they go too hard after him, they're seen as unpresidential, they're seen as going after a man who's been a victim of a gun crime, and yet at the same time you have to hit on your attack points and you have to go after him and challenge him and be robust to try and get there and win the presidency. It puts them in a very, very difficult situation. And I wonder, does it make the Biden candidacy more likely that he will stay, because at least he has the benefits of office? He can be presidential, call for calm and peace, and say that we need to bring the country together and hope that at some point Trump in his reaction goes over the top and looks unpresidential or is trying to milk what has happened, which is the antithesis of what has made some of these former assassination victims so popular. If you look at the likes of FDR, he was the hard man about it. He rushed the mayor of Chicago, who was fatally shot in his attempt to hospital at the time. Reagan joking with the people who were performing surgery on him. You know, it's a very,
I hope,
different.
You're all Republicans, I think he joked. And then, honey, I forgot to duck. And tell us about the FDR one, because that was in 1933. So it was after his election as president, but before his inauguration. Mm. So he was the president-elect and holidaying in Miami, and a gunman opened fire, the mayor, as you say, of Chicago, next to him, fatally wounded. And, you know, that was one of these horrific, shocking examples as well.
Absolutely. And like you say, slightly different time to the Trump one in that he was the president-elect already. He gave an impromptu speech from the back of the car. It's a short enough 3-5 minute speech, and he sort of slides back down into the seat, and then you hear 5 or 6 gunshots go off, and the gunman managed to hit pretty much everyone around him except for FDR. Like I said, the mayor of Chicago fatally wounded in the attack, but other people, you know, jumping in on top. Then he called for restraint from the crowd. Now, this man was it's kind of, when you look at the assassination attempts down through history, there's a lot of mental illness involved, and a lot of mental illness seen through the time and what we thought of at the time. And he was an immigrant. He had come from an Italian background, an unemployed bricklayer, was saying basically he had nothing against FDR personally, but was shooting against the system that had led to the Great Depression and everything else in it. FDR, as he was being rushed off, said, you know, don't kill this man, don't beat him to death, because the crowd had turned on him and rushed his friend to hospital and got a very big boost in the public opinion from it. Very interestingly, just as a side note, that incident is actually where the term death row comes from, because at the time the man Giuseppe Sangara, he was sentenced to death for his murder crime, but there was a rule in Florida prisons that you couldn't house a convicted murder criminal in a cell with anyone else, and there was already someone in the waiting cell awaiting death, awaiting the electric chair, so they had to build another one, and that's where the kind of popular term death row came from, because they now had two of them waiting on the chair.
And Sean, there was some criticism of the Secret Service in the wake of the attempted assassination of Trump. The fact that they, well, first that it happened, and second that even after the shooting, he was allowed to rise to his feet, and he did the fist bump and the shouting of fight, fight, but that they should have just dragged him away. And similarly with the shooting of FDR, the Secret Service attempted to drag him away, but he said, no, go back for the mayor, go back for Tony, and held him in his arms, cradled him in his arms. And some people watching said, God, he showed no nerves at all, and that he was absolutely fearless. And you saw kind of examples of that or something similar with the more recent events.
Yeah, that's it. It's trying to take command of the political moment, and Donald Trump absolutely did that to the max. You know, you can see, again, the footage is so shocking, as you see him reach for his ear as if something is swatted on it, and actually look at the blood, and then the realisation comes. He ducks down. You have this strange moment where the Secret Service are saying, let's get you out of here, and he's saying, my shoes, what about my shoes? You know, had they fallen off or whatever, which was sort of strange, but he absolutely capitalised on it. And I think the moment that he has won the election coming is that photograph, is the image. He ducks his head above the civil service, the arm is up, the American flag in the background, sort of Iwo Jima-esque, and the blood streaked across his face. So talking about making the most of the moment. And you see that down throughout history as well, from those who have survived the attack we mentioned with Reagan as well, with FDR, that it's not necessarily that they survived and were shot, it's the way they did it, looking strong, looking presidential, and that is what brought people along with them in the aftermath.
Michael, there are few examples in American history of former presidents running in the elections. You have usually a current president, an incumbent, or else you have someone who wants to become president. But ever since they brought in the two-term limit in 1951, you don't really see former presidents. But you did see it in 1912 when Theodore Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, decided to challenge his handpicked successor, Taft, didn't get the Republican nomination, ran as a progressive, and up against Woodrow Wilson as well. And there was an attempted assassination of him in 1912, a few weeks before the election.
Yeah, that's right. And it's actually in the same city where the Republican National Convention is held at the moment, which is Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And in that incident, Theodore Roosevelt was leaving the Gilpatrick Hotel on his way to deliver a speech on the campaign trail. And when he's exiting the hotel, John Schrank, an assassin, shoots him nearly point blank range and kind of right into where your pocket on your shirt might be. In his pocket is a glasses case, a metal glasses case. And on the inside on his jacket is his speech, which he folded in half. And the bullet passes through the metal glasses case, then through a 20 or 30 page folded piece of paper, and then into his chest. And interestingly, Roosevelt, being a hunter, probably this is the reason why he carried on to deliver that speech quite famously, is because he didn't cough up any blood. And being a hunter, he knew that that meant that the bullet hadn't actually entered his lung. But the bullet remained in his body for the duration of 90 minutes afterwards, when he got delivered this speech to, you know, a huge crowd of Wisconsins, and then eventually went to the hospital afterwards. And like FDR, he also tells the crowd, you know, not to attack the assassin, who is, I think the crowd turns on and, you know, tries to beat, and they arrest him. And Roosevelt speaks to him briefly and asks him why, you know, what his motives were for shooting him. And he doesn't make any sense. And so Roosevelt just sort of dispatches him to his jail cell and gets on with things. But interestingly, all this talk about what an assassin's bullet does to your popularity, it doesn't elect Roosevelt. He loses that election, although he does come second. He beats Taft in that election. He doesn't beat Wilson, and he doesn't gain the plurality that was needed to win that election.
So it doesn't necessarily guarantee you success, even if you do respond in that heroic way and in that very dramatic way that he did. And I've read about that speech in the Milwaukee Auditorium. It's only about 500 meters from where the Republican convention was this week. And there he stands up, he takes out the speech, and the bullet has gone through it. He opens his coat and his shirt is bloodied. And to go on and deliver that long speech, in a way that it was the long speech that saved his life, because the paper was so thick and it was so long. But it's incredible to think of someone giving a speech after having been shot.
It is. And incidentally, that's going to be a major feature at the Presidential Library when it opens in 2026. We've actually taken to call it the bullet sandwich, because, you know, there's so many parts to it, and it's arranged like a sandwich, the bullet passing through these various layers. It is incredible. I think there's some really other incredible moments that we haven't spoken about yet, of not just presidents, but congresspeople who have been shot or beaten. I mean, perhaps the most famous one is Charles Sumner's caning in the floor of Congress. I mean, you know, that really changes the mood on abolition and slavery in America in a way. I mean, this kind of gets to everyone's point that political violence in America is a mainstay, but it does have a real lasting implication for how Americans view democracy and the whole American experiment more generally. So Gabby Giffords getting shot, you know, that was back in the early 2000s, and now she survived and her husband is a senator. So we can see sort of some of the impact there, but also Steve Scalise, who was shot at a baseball game not so many years back. He probably, you know, because of that and his other health issues, didn't become the Speaker of the House more recently. So there's a long story of political violence in America and the impact that it has on careers and as well as the overall mindset of the electorate.
And Michael, Sean there was talking about some of the assassins and the various mental health problems that they had. John Schrank, who shot Teddy Roosevelt, he seems to have been obsessed with the idea of candidates, of presidents running for a third term, which wasn't unconstitutional at that point, and believed that McKinley's ghost had appeared to him, the former president who himself had been assassinated, and that he was urging him to stop Teddy Roosevelt winning that election.
So that's exactly right in terms of what Schrank said. There's a combination there of both a political ideology as well as mental health issue. And I think that is almost certainly always the case. I mean, you can think about Charles Guiteau, who killed James Garfield. He was someone who was expecting to get a federal job because he was a Republican and he campaigned for Republicans. And when the spoils system was being reformed by Garfield and by other Republicans, he thought that was a slight against him personally as well as politically against the spoils system. And so that's his motive for killing Garfield. Obviously, with Lincoln, you know, you have abolition and the end of slavery, emancipation and the changing of the South, giving Booth the reason to and of course, he says sic semper tyrannis, you know, death to tyrants. So there's obviously politics wrapped up in all of this, but there's certainly mental health issues as well. I mean, you can think about Reagan's assassin. You can think about we still don't know the motive for Trump's assassin, but I imagine it will have a combination of both some political ideology. Apparently, he was a Republican, so that'll be interesting to unpack. You know, when it comes time, but there can't not be some sort of mental health disorder associated with this because we're talking about murder. So we have to keep that in mind, certainly. But I wouldn't want to not think further about the political motives of these players as well.
Dan, the shooting of Teddy Roosevelt contributed to his iconography, the legend of this tough politician who would go on and deliver the speech even after being shot. And you see similar images then with Trump in the way that he raised the fist, the way he went to the convention a few days later, the way he carried on and that show of defiance. But it didn't work for Teddy Roosevelt. It's not necessarily going to work for Trump, although it probably makes his re-election more likely.
Yeah, I take the view that there's still 3.5 months there or thereabouts to go before polling day, and a lot of things can happen in that time. So, especially in the times we live in, where things are rather fast-moving, shall we say, and are amplified by social media. So, while I think it does certainly boost Trump's standing, and I dare say there will be a bump for him in the polls, but that bump always happens anyway after the convention. So I think we will see in the coming week or so a bump for Trump and in the polls, and that will then, I think, raise again the issue of whether Joe Biden should actually be the candidate to stand against Trump in November. And especially, I think, if you start to see Democrats in the Senate or Senate candidates and House candidates worrying that a big loss for Joe Biden could also hand a big majority in the Senate to the Republicans and could also prevent the Democrats from retaking a majority in the House of Representatives. And if that were to happen, of course, that would be a trifecta for the Republicans and would mean that there'd be no restraint on a future Trump administration. So I think there's a lot of road to be traveled yet on the issue of who stands for the Democrats. But at the moment, certainly the pressure has come off Joe Biden. But could I also just say a little bit about the motives of the assassins? I mean, you can say that the motive for Lincoln's assassination was political. It was someone, although a showman, Wilkes Booth, he did have an animus against Lincoln because of the abolition of slavery and because he was a Confederate sympathizer. And likewise, William McKinley's assassination in 1901 was done by an anarchist who was inspired by the assassination the previous year of King Umberto of Italy. And remember, there was a series of assassinations by anarchists in the late 19th century. You had the assassination of the Empress Elizabeth of Austria-Hungary in 1898, and then you had Umberto being killed by an anarchist in 1900, and then in 1901 William McKinley. But after that, it becomes difficult to determine any motive. Like, what was the motive for Lee Harvey Oswald? I know it's been the subject of many conspiracy theories. It's very interesting to think about why it is that these assassins do what they've done. And the other thing to say is that, assassinations are not completely unknown in Europe either. After all, in the last 40 years, we've had the assassination of Olaf Palme and Anna Lindh in Sweden. And Sweden would be regarded as one of the most liberal and, least likely places to have a kind of a gun culture that would lead to, or a culture of such animosity that would lead to the assassination of two senior Swedish figures within the space of 10 years.
And in Britain, we had the assassination of Joe Cox, the Labour MP, in 2016, and that horrified people both here and in Britain and around the world as well, that there is something that when a politician or a political candidate is killed, it's an attack on them and their family, but it's an attack on democracy as well.
Yes, it certainly is. And as I say, if you look at, the list of assassinations, and you find that every country, Europe, has a list of assassinations, including, by the way, Ireland, where obviously we had the assassination of Lord Cavendish in 1882 in the Phoenix Park, but also many assassination attempts and successful assassinations of different figures in Irish history. So assassination is not just an American thing. I think the difference in America is this sort of this gun culture that means that the assassinations tend to be very largely caused by people who have access to guns, like this young man in Pennsylvania had last week.
And it's interesting that Irish comparison you've raised, because, of course, a lot of those since independence would have been in that first decade, the assassination of the Minister for Justice, Kevin O'Higgins, in 1927. And I suppose you could even say the assassination of Michael Collins during the Civil War and so many of the deaths around that period, that was the bloodiest period in terms of Irish democracy.
But it's interesting also, Patrick, that in Europe, in France, there hasn't been an assassination since the Second World War. Likewise, in Germany, there hasn't been a significant assassination, a significant political figure. I think the last, the major countries of Europe, which previously had these, pretty horrendous histories of assassination, there was an assassination of a Spanish prime minister in the 1970s who was part of the Franco regime. But, the assassination, apart from the strange exception of Sweden with Palme and Lindh, assassination seems to have waned in Europe as a phenomenon, although we did have recently the attempted assassination of the Prime Minister of Slovakia.
And the last Irish politician to be assassinated, Senator Billy Fox, 50 years ago in 1974 by the Provisional IRA, and a horrific tragedy there as well. Okay, well, we are talking history. We are talking about shootings in American presidential history. We'll take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be joined by Dr. Sandra Scanlon from UCD, and we'll be talking about the assassinations of Abraham Lincoln and John F. Kennedy. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about shootings in American presidential history. And I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Sandra Scanlon, who lectures in American history in the UCD School of History and is an expert on American political culture and its relationship with US foreign policy during the Cold War. And she's the author of The Pro-War Movement, Domestic Support for the Vietnam War, and The Making of Modern American Conservatism. And also staying with us, Dan Mulhall, the distinguished former diplomat and historian, Professor Michael Cullinan of Dickinson State University, and Sean Defoe, the political correspondent for Bauer Media. Sandra, we have had shootings of sitting presidents. Andrew Jackson was the first president to be shot at while in office in 1835. I think the bullets missed him and he wasn't killed. But the first president to be killed in office was Abraham Lincoln when he was assassinated in 1865. And coming at the end of the American Civil War in such a traumatic period in American history, that was also such a traumatic and shocking event.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was only 5 days after the official ending of the American Civil War, which we often forget is the bloodiest war in American history. So 600,000 Americans had died. Enormous sort of, consequences domestically in terms of the kind of impact of that on the whole nation. And then to have the president, who had quite a conciliatory approach to bringing the nation back together, that wasn't necessarily understood by everyone at the time, But to have him die under those circumstances when the situation was so politically fraught in any case was shocking in Washington and really shocking throughout both the Union and indeed in the Confederacy. It was not something that was necessarily celebrated even amongst those who had been in rebellion against Lincoln and the Union.
And then we had that incredible kind of coincidence where the president who was elected in 1860, Lincoln, was killed in 1865. The president who was elected 20 years after 1860 in 1880, Garfield, he was killed in 1881. The president who was elected in 1900, McKinley, he was killed in 1901. And then that was almost replicated in the 20th century because Kennedy elected in 1960, killed in 1963. Ronald Reagan, who we'll be talking about later, you know, shot in 1981. And it is kind of shocking that you had four sitting presidents killed in office. And I suppose in terms of the 20th century, that the assassination of John F. Kennedy is that big, dramatic, iconic one, because he was so young, because he was a sitting president, because there was all of that promise and potential. And whether that was the mythology or not, it was seen as kind of almost the cheating of American idealism.
Yeah, and I think it's similar with Kennedy and Lincoln. You can really see those parallels, that sense of what could have been. Kennedy's assassination is obviously more traumatic in some ways immediately because of the fact that it's the nature of television, that it's so immediate to people. And it had been such a long time since McKinley's assassination, the idea that, well, you know, presidents have so much security, this is not something that could happen again. So with Kennedy, there's the immediate shock. And then there is, as you say, that really strong kind of mythology almost that develops over the next 10 years, that sense of what could he have done had he been president. And the background to that is obviously Vietnam, because there's a very rapidly after the escalation of the war in Vietnam, there's people talking about how he wouldn't have done this, he wouldn't have done it the way that he did. And certainly, I think you can see that's reflected in the different personalities between Kennedy and Johnson, who succeeded Kennedy. But the reality is that the potential that Kennedy's presidency would have been radically different from Lyndon Johnson, that you wouldn't have had the kind of domestic upheaval that you had, is probably that kind of, you know, retrospective mythology that's really created around Kennedy.
And Sandra, why have there been so many conspiracy theories around, especially the Kennedy assassination? There's a whole vast literature of that. There's certain conspiracy theories about Lincoln and some of the other ones, but it seems that people are unwilling to accept the established version of events, and they prefer to think, no, there must be some other elements. It's the CIA, it's the FBI, it's the Russians, it's, you know, God knows who. Lyndon B. Johnson's involved, everything's involved. That it does seem to be a problem when people try and discuss and consider what happened.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is that with Lincoln, it really was a conspiracy. We know that there was people involved in, you know, working together to try and kill him and kill others in leadership positions to try and bring down the government, in a sense that, you know, there's almost a plan there that we can create this chaos. With Kennedy, it's very clear it was Lee Harvey Oswald. It was one individual. There was no plan for what was going to happen afterward. Kennedy was going to be killed, as he was, but, you know, it's not as if this was going to bring down the government, create such chaos as potentially could have been the situation after Lincoln's assassination. I think it goes to this sense of how could one person, in the form of 24-year-old Lee Harvey Oswald, create the downfall of an individual who, in as I said, you know, in terms of retrospect, was really held up as almost an idyllic president, somebody who was going to achieve so much for the nation. How could one individual alone achieve this? But the reality is that it was one individual who brought down the president, and, you know, was able to do so because of the fact he happened to be in the right place from his point of view at the right time. But the conspiracies that really develop around that, I think, have to go to the chaos that ensues over the course of the next 10 years and all of the kind of fallout that we see after Watergate and so forth. The idea that, you know, there are these, you know, the secret activities happening in government that only really become known to the public in the 1970s. And then retrospectively, people start to look back and say, well, if the CIA was trying to assassinate, you know, Castro and others, it was doing all these illegal activities abroad, then perhaps it was involved. The same kind of activity could be taking place on domestic soil. So I think that's where it's really the aftermath, the kind of 10 years after, that you start to see these major conspiracies develop around Kennedy's assassination.
Michael, I think if you were to ask people how many American presidents have been killed in office, people would know and be able to give the names of Lincoln and Kennedy. They may struggle, though, when it comes to Garfield and McKinley, and might not realise that actually it was four presidents. And in many ways, Garfield and McKinley are very much in the shade, even though the assassination of McKinley propelled Teddy Roosevelt to the presidency.
I mean, Garfield's assassination is something that almost everyone forgets, including Americans, I think. So it's not just exclusive to Europeans. And that's because he was only in office for the guts of a month, a bit longer than that. But I mean, you know, he really didn't even have time to get ranked. He wasn't in office long enough for scholars to rank his presidency, whether it was a success or a failure. And yet, actually, the death of Garfield has lasting implications, just like the death of Kennedy does for civil rights. And that is the passage of the Pendleton Act and the redefinition of the spoil system in the United States. It's the end of political spoils. It's, well, not the complete end, but it's the beginning of the end of political spoils and career bureaucrats. So, I mean, it has a real lasting implication, as does the assassination of McKinley, which it leads to the creation of a Secret Service that is dedicated to the protection of the president. Before that, they worked on, you know, counterfeiting measures and stuff like that. But after McKinley's death, the Secret Service comes in, and until JFK's assassination, there are no further assassinations on presidents. Of course, the assassination attempt on Roosevelt, there wasn't protection for former presidents then, and that's brought in later as well. So all of these have real lasting implications that we might forget originally stem from the fact that these men were killed.
And Sean, when you look at the Kennedy assassination and LBJ taking over as president, there is always that shadow that hangs over him then, because it's, as Sandra says, there's always that idea of what would Kennedy have done. And yet someone like Lyndon B. Johnson was able to use the image of Kennedy and the martyr's cause to probably go further in areas of civil rights than Kennedy himself would have gone.
Yeah, one of those cases of the coin flipping. And if the reason, you know, it's like it's been mentioned, there's so many conspiracy theories about why JFK was killed, but if one of the reasons was going towards the civil rights, then it had completely the opposite effect, because as you say, Johnson was able to go that further, push it further down the line. And that's where you get one of those cases of the assassination having the other impact, as it were. So, you know, you can look at Trump and say, if it was, and we don't really know the motive as to why this assassination attempt took place, but if it was that someone looked at him and said, well, you're a danger to America, we don't know how that would have played out had it been actually successful. So it's an interesting one where it's almost the inverse in maybe trying to make America more conservative at the time of the JFK shooting. They made it more liberal, and the inverse could have happened had the assassination on Sunday been successful.
Dan, you've been Ireland's ambassador to the United Kingdom as well as to the United States. In Britain, you have the example of one Prime Minister, Spencer Percival, assassinated in office. In America, as we've heard, you have four examples there. Is that a reflection of the gun culture and the prevalence of guns in the United States, that you do just have such a greater number of presidents killed in office, shot in office, and candidates killed and shot?
Yeah, I think it obviously is. Although I would add that although Spencer Percival was the only prime minister assassinated, there were assassination attempts on successive monarchs, British monarchs. Queen Victoria, I think, was the subject of six or seven different attempts. Now, you know, none of them were successful, or even maybe came close to being successful. But yes, I mean, America is a place where, remember, you know, the frontiersmen, you know, going back to the American Revolution, the Minutemen, the gun has played a significant part in American history and is part of America, because, I mean, to tame the West, Americans needed to be armed to go out there. I mean, you know, we now look at it as a terrible thing that the, you know, Native Americans were deprived of their land and birthright and so forth. But for, you know, in American history, that story of America conquering that continent was a story that happened to the barrel of a gun in many ways. Could I also just mentioned about the Lincoln assassination, because I suppose one of the big questions about that is that would Lincoln have done a better job of the post-Civil War America, which, you know, went awry pretty quickly, Reconstruction fell apart. I think Andrew Johnson, who succeeded Lincoln, is regarded as maybe the worst president in American history, or pretty close to it. And if you look at the succession of presidents after Lincoln and until Teddy Roosevelt, you have Rutherford B. Hayes, Garfield, Chester Arthur, Grover Cleveland, who was president twice, but there was Benjamin Harrison in between, and then William McKinley. So the American presidency went through a bit of a trough until it was revived by Teddy Roosevelt, who had a much more modern approach. Remember, some of the previous presidents actually campaigned from their front porch. So they weren't really maybe as exposed to assassination attempts as presidents in the 20th century have been. And we've had these examples of that we've mentioned already, of Bobby Kennedy, George Wallace, and so forth, you know, being and now Donald Trump being the victims of assassination attempts while they were campaigning to be the president of the United States.
Well, we are going to take a quick break now. And my thanks to Dr. Sandra Scanlon from the UCD School of History for joining me for this part of the show. When we come back, I'll be rejoined by my panel as we talk about the shooting of Ronald Reagan in 1981, the killing of Bobby Kennedy in 1968, and what impact the shooting of Donald Trump will have on the November election. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about shootings in American presidential history. I'm rejoined by my brilliant panel, Daniel Mulhall, the distinguished former diplomat and historian, a former ambassador to the United States. We're also rejoined by Professor Michael Cullinan, the Lauman Walter Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies at Dickinson State University and the public historian for the Theodore Roosevelt Association, Sean Defoe, the political correspondent for Bauer Media, and earlier there we were talking to Dr. Sandra Scanlon, who lectures in American history in the UCD School of History. Michael, can we talk about the shooting of Ronald Reagan in 1981? Because there you see someone who only was recently inaugurated, and that was a shooting that did shock and horrify the American public and indeed the world.
Yeah, I think Reagan's shooting absolutely had a number of effects. First of all, it was the first political assassination attempt since JFK, and we know that JFK's assassination really upended American political culture and society more generally. But the shock of it was media had captured this moment, not unlike the Zapruder film, but unlike it in the sense that the 24-hour news cycle was in existence, and so we were fed the scene of that shooting over and over again. And the other reason why I think this was important as well is because it showed some of the constitutional weakness at the heart of the American system and the problems for democracy here. And that really has to do with Al Haig. Al Haig was Secretary of State, who decided after Reagan was shot that he was next in line for succession, not George H.W. Bush, who, of course, was next in line to succession. So Haig began running cabinet meetings, and, you know, the appearance of him effectively taking over really shocked the nation. But it effectively doomed Haig's political career, and he was removed by Reagan a couple of years later. So an assassination strikes at the heart of, I guess, in any country's democratic processes, and it can lead to major upheavals. In this case, in Reagan's shooting, it was Al Haig and George H.W. Bush vying for the sort of succession of Reagan.
And Michael, the gunman there was John Hinckley Jr., who seems to have been obsessed by the character played by Jodie Foster in the movie Taxi Driver, and that in some twisted way thought that this was the secret of winning her over by killing the president.
I mean, yeah, so this is Hinckley's attempt to kill Reagan is one of those instances that it seems entirely down to a mental health condition. You know, I mean, we've talked about other assassins that have heard voices, whether it was, the ghost of McKinley telling Frank to shoot Roosevelt. But Hinckley's attempt seems entirely based on a mental health condition. And he spent several decades in a mental facility, a mental home facility, and he was released only years before his eventual demise, natural causes. And he appealed many times to leave that facility on parole, saying that he had, he'd felt much better and that, he was, not a threat to society anymore. But, the American public never forgave him, really, for the attempt on Reagan's life. And recently, there was an editorial by Patty Reagan about how that shot really changed their family and how it transformed not just American society, but also the Reagan family itself. And it, it really tortured Nancy and Ron and Patty and others. And so I think it's worth thinking also about the personal implications of an assassination attempt and what that can do to the people that are at the heart of the system.
And Michael, it probably benefited Reagan in the long term and even in the short term politically, because he was the surviving hero then. He went to that session of Congress and received the standing ovation. He was able to get his economic policies passed. That the way he handled it, his courage under fire, that became an enduring part of the Reagan image and the Reagan legend.
I think you're right, and I think there is certainly evidence that that happened for Reagan and for other presidents as well. Whether we think about the radical Republicans that followed in Lyndon's assassination, whether we think of Lyndon Johnson, the civil rights movement after JFK's assassination. I mean, Reagan had a lot of other things going for him as well. I mean, the economy luckily rebounds in 1983, 84, about the time when he's going to go for re-election. And the Reagan revolution was real, and that happened before the 1981 assassination attempt. So there was a sort of an invisible bridge from the conservatism of Barry Goldwater to Reagan that was pushing America to the right. And I think that can't be discounted. However, I mean, this is great PR. I mean, getting shot somehow is great PR for presidents. And so, you know, any president would use that in order to, you know, sort of create the myth and the machismo that we've been talking about with, say, Roosevelt. That translates to all other presidents that are shot. And we're seeing it today with Trump as well. I mean, the heroics, and I dare say heroics, of him putting his fist up and saying, hang on, I've just been shot, but I want to kind of show off my macho cred here. I mean, that has long-lasting implications for political capital. Once you survive, of course.
And Dan, we also have the examples of, we've mentioned some of them, candidates seeking the nomination of their political party for the presidency and being shot. George Wallace was seeking the Democratic nomination in 1972 and was shot and injured. But then, of course, we have that incredible tragedy in 1968 when Bobby Kennedy was seeking the Democratic nomination and he was killed. And coming only 5 years after the killing of his brother, it was one of those, I think, hugely significant moments in American political history.
Yes. I mean, I think even before the assassination attempt on Donald Trump, this year was, you know, was setting up to be a kind of a very similar year to 68, with such a great degree of partisanship and upheaval. And of course, the Democratic convention next month will take place in Chicago, where the 68 convention took place. Now, of course, the difference in 68 was that the backdrop was the Vietnam War. But I personally, when I was ambassador in Washington, I was invited by the Kennedy family to read one of Robert Kennedy's speeches at a ceremony in Arlington Cemetery to mark the 50th anniversary of his assassination. And it caused me, obviously, to look into the whole RFK legacy and the potential that he had as a candidate. And I think one thing about RFK is that he may be the greatest president that America never had. Now, of course, here we're dealing with virtual history because we can't know for sure how it would have panned out. Would he have beaten Richard Nixon? I think most people think he probably would have. But I certainly came across a lot of people from that, you know, remember that era when I was in America, who you know, really believed that RFK was the real deal and could have made a big difference to America, could have sort of built upon the legacy of his brother and could have sort of restored a greater degree of moderation and progressive politics to American politics. And instead, because of the upheavals of 68, including the assassination of RFK and of Martin Luther King, Richard Nixon ended up as the president, and we all know how that one ended up.
Sean, it's hard to draw lessons out from this historical record, because you have some cases where the person was shot and killed, in other cases shot at and survived, and very different consequences, very different impacts depending on what exactly happened.
Yeah, it can play out in a whole variety of different ways, and you almost do the exercise in your head, don't you? What if that bullet for Trump was 2 inches to the right and we weren't talking about him surviving and all this today? Would the Republican Party have stayed lurched to Trump politics, and would you see someone like J.D. Vance coming through, or would you see a Ron DeSantis maybe, or would it recorrect itself? How would history play out otherwise and go back to maybe where the Republican Party was 10, 15 years ago? I think the big thing to take away, and you can see this all throughout history, it's not necessarily just with America, we tend to have this imagination in our head that assassinations are very carefully planned and that there's a plan for the aftermath that, you know, this is going to happen. We're going to kill this candidate because we like this other guy and put him in instead. And that turns out not to be the case. A lot of the time it is one person acting on their own. You go back to as far as ancient Rome, you think of the assassination of Julius Caesar, and they did it and then sort of all looked around and said, well, what now? And all of them were dead within 3 years and they ended up with an emperor anyway, you know? So these things can play out very, very differently throughout history than people might think. And the political consequences often end up acting contrary to what the assassin intended.
And I think cinema misleads us, because whenever you see these attempted assassinations on screen, it's always, you know, eagle down and they rush to it and it's all perfectly choreographed and super efficient. And but here we saw absolute chaos and people didn't seem to know what they were doing. If there had been a second gunman, they would have been able to take another shot, because Trump raised himself up and that certainly shouldn't have been allowed to happen in case there had been someone else there. And what we saw was the chaos and confusion of it.
Well, it raises huge questions for the Secret Service. And without going into all the conspiracies of deep state that we've already talked about, like, I've been in Secret Service cordons when visiting the White House or whenever the US president has come here. They are usually absolutely watertight. You don't go anywhere. You don't move an inch as a journalist from where they tell you, because otherwise you've someone with a gun or a sniffer dog or somebody on top of you. So to let this building, which was a very obvious vantage point for a shooter, to go unchecked, to not, you know, you have the remarkable images of people telling the police there's someone up there with a gun and nothing being done about it, raises absolute huge and fundamental questions for the Secret Service. And the Secret Service has its history in assassinations. It was initially started, had nothing to do with protection of the president. Then they had a small role. They had a role in protecting McKinley when he was shot. And it was only after his assassination that they became the full-time personal guard for presidents and former presidents. But there's going to have to be huge questions asked, because if that can happen to a former president, it could happen to a sitting president, could happen to the other people that they're guarding.
And Sean, I'll leave the final word with you. Do you think that when the dust settles on this election campaign, will we see this attempted assassination as a critical point in that story?
It will be. It'll be a huge talking point. As to how much it's actually going to shape the election, because the immediate aftermath was, this has won it, it's over, you know, Donald Trump is in, forget all about it. There's a long time to go now, and we all expected on the eve of Donald Trump's first election in 2016 that he wasn't going to win it. So, you know, events, dear boy, events, they can happen and they can change everything. But certainly as we sit now in July talking about it, it looks like it's his to lose. And as long as he handles the aftermath well in the way that he has so far and been magnanimous and presidential in a way he hasn't been in previous campaigns, it's his to lose.
Well, my thanks to my brilliant panel of experts for joining me tonight to talk about shootings in American presidential history. Dan Mulhall, the distinguished former diplomat and former ambassador to the United States, Professor Michael Cullinan of Dickinson State University in North Dakota, Sean Defoe, the political correspondent for Barron Media, and earlier there we were also delighted to be joined by Dr. Sandra Scanlon of the UCD School of History. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer Marisa Sullivan and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been talking history. Good night.